and for the good fortune of living close to one another. Then we talk about turkeys. Turkeys have no flavor. The trimmings are worse. Do Americans like turkey? I don't think they do. Meanwhile, all the food, including the turkey and trimmings, gets eaten, and we all share the American tradition of feeling more stuffed than the bird. Then it's time for dessert. Baklava, fruit, pastries, and pumpkin pie, which we serve with Persian ice cream. With its chunks of cream, roasted pistachios, and aromatic cardamom, Persian ice cream serves as a reminder that Persia was once one of the greatest empires in the world. I believe peace in the Middle East could be achieved if the various leaders held their discussions in front of a giant bowl of Persian ice cream, each leader with his own silver spoon. Political differences would melt with every mouthful. During our Thanksgiving meal, my father gives thanks for living in a free country where he can vote. I always share gratitude for being able to pursue my hopes and dreams, despite being female. My relatives and I are proud to be Iranian, but we also give tremendous thanks for our lives in America, a nation where freedom reigns. But although land of the free refers to the essential freedoms that make this country the greatest democracy on earth, it could also refer to the abundance of free samples available throughout this great land. In our homeland, people who taste something before they buy it are called shoplifters. Here, a person can taste something, not buy it, and still have the clerk wish him a nice day. A few months ago, my father mentioned that he had gone out to lunch with his brother, Nematullah. I was quite surprised because my father's idea of eating out is going to sisters' houses. My two aunts, who live in small, modest homes with tiny kitchens, are always ready to serve whoever drops by around mealtime, a term loosely defined as anywhere between breakfast and bedtime, give or take 2 hours. Their generosity and genuine delight in feeding others prove my theory that the more modest and impractical the kitchen, the more likely one will be invited to stay for a meal. Show me a fancy house with a top-of-the-line gourmet kitchen, and I'll show you a family that eats out a lot. So where did you go? I asked my father. Price Club, he said. Price Club is a chain of huge warehouses that sells items in large quantities. Toilet paper comes in packages of 36 rolls, and one box of muffin mix yields 144 muffins. As far as I know, Price Club has no restaurant. Puzzled, I probed further. What did you eat there? Samples, he replied. Price Club has samples, rows and rows of endless samples. Itching to try the latest frozen chicken burrito or those mini hot dogs that come in mini buns? How about some instant soup, ice cream sandwiches, spaghetti sauce, or pork buns? It's all there, and it's all free. The mind-boggling generosity even extends to second and third helpings. I have witnessed people hanging around the Mrs. Fields sample table far longer than it takes to actually chew one and walk away. These anonymous people who shamelessly eat their way through the store now have a face, my father's. So what did you actually eat? I inquired. I don't know, he replied. It all tasted the same. Under normal circumstances, my father would not eat a frozen Western-style fish enchilada. But give him a free sample and all rules of judgment and taste are suspended. The same goes for airline food. Once he finishes his own tray, he is more than happy to finish ours. You're not going to eat that, he asks, referring to whatever the rest of us have found to be inedible. Give it to me. My father is every flight attendant's dream, simplifying the stacking process by thoroughly emptying each tray. A few years ago, my brother Fashid sent my parents on a first-class vacation to Japan. They weren't as impressed by Japan as they were by the food service in first class. My father did admit, though, that he felt ill after the flight. I ate nonstop, he said. When my parents returned from their trip, they presented me with, among other gifts, 14 mini jars of jam. What are these from? I asked. Breakfast in the airplane, my mother replied. We each got 2 jars. What about the other 10 jars? I asked, not wanting to know the answer. Those are from the other passengers who didn't want theirs. I envisioned the first class passengers spreading their cloth napkins on their laps when suddenly, do you want the jelly? My mother, with her thick Middle Eastern accent, could just as easily have asked for their passports, which the passengers would have handed over gladly just to get rid of her. It is fair to assume that by the time my parents shuffled off the airplane, their pockets laden with a bounty of wrapped sugar cubes and tiny bottles of ketchup, the entire cabin knew that my parents usually fly coach. My parents' hunting and gathering instincts are not limited to the freebies in first class. They also get their money's worth in coach. My children know that a visit from their grandparents means a dozen packets of American Airlines peanuts. How do they get so many? My mother has a system. I tell them that I'm visiting my grandkids and they love peanuts. I assume that works better than telling the truth. I'm paying $150 for this seat and I would like the equivalent in free food. Evidently, my parents are not the only ones unable to resist the pull of a free meal. Denny's, one of my father's favorite American restaurants, serves free birthday meals. Denny's assumes, of course, that nobody would go to eat a birthday meal alone. It is fair to expect that a person celebrating his birthday would bring along a few paying friends. Of course, there is an exception to every rule, and Kazem is his name. My father has no idea of his exact birth date. Whenever a child was born in his family, someone made a notation in the family Quran. The flaw in this system became apparent when someone lost the Quran. My father and his siblings have had to rely on one another's memories to approximate their ages. He was born the year of the flood, which makes him 75. No, that can't be right. He was born the year I learned how to read, so he's 77. No, he was born the year all the chickens died. He's 71, maybe 72. When my parents were coming to America, my father had to choose a birth date. Ever the practical man, he decided on March 18th, my mother's birthday. This way, he figured, filling out paperwork would be considerably easier since he would only have to remember one date. His system was flawless until Denny's marketing gurus started offering those free birthday meals. Every March 18th, my parents would experience the same scene. "Isn't that adorable?" the waitress always said. "Matching birthdays! Hey, Oscar, check this out!" To get their free chicken fried steak, my parents had to endure the inquisition. "How did you two meet? When did you realize you have the same birthday? That is the cutest thing I have ever seen." Rather than go into the whole, "We somehow lost the Quran and that's why we have the same birthday" story, my parents just smiled and hoped the waitress would go away. Eventually, my father decided to go to Denny's alone on his birthday, thus avoiding the entire "ain't it romantic to have the same birthday" scenario. When my father retired, he found himself with lots of free time. Retirement traditionally brings out men's true passions: golfing, fishing, spelunking. Ever since he retired, what was once a mere pastime of my father's has now become a full-time mania that can be summed up in one word: timeshares. My parents still live in Newport Beach, an affluent community full of tanned, yacht-loving, tennis-playing people named Fritz and Binky. My parents have nothing in common with any other resident of the town. They're not rich, they play no sports, and I'm quite sure that neither one knows how to spell or pronounce yacht. But they have one thing in common with their neighbors: a zip code that means money. My parents are regular targets for marketers looking to sell anything to presumably wealthy retirees. When my father was working, my mother got rid of the nasty telemarketers with a standard response delivered in her thick accent: "I am the maid." Any mail soliciting anything was thrown away before my father came home. All this changed after my father retired. Now a cheerful, eager immigrant greets any marketer who calls the house. People hawking timeshares are the most insidious, luring their prospective victims with far more than the usual free t-shirt or can opener. They offer everything from a free overnight stay at a nice hotel to a free dinner to a $50 gift certificate. All you have to do is attend one of their seminars, which are basically long infomercials without the benefit of a mute button. Far better trained than the CIA and more persistent than Hare Krishnas, These salespeople know how to corner their unsuspecting prey and make them sign away their life savings. One minute, you're laughing with the nice salesperson. The next minute, you own a timeshare in Des Moines. Somehow, my parents survived their first timeshare experience without buying anything, but the sales tactics were so forceful that my mother swore she would never go again. My father, the taste of the free filet mignon still lingering in his mouth, wasn't ready to quit. He was upset that my mother did not want to make timeshares a regular part of their twilight years. "Why can't you just go and have a good time?" he asked her. Perhaps the same can be asked of patients going to the dentist for root canals. Timeshare seminars have a certain addictive quality. Unable to convince my mother to join him, my father recruited Uncle Nematullah, who brought with him the added advantage of speaking less English than my mother. This was a good thing, since his inability to understand the sales pitches rendered him far less likely to sign on any dotted line. My uncle just wanted to know when their free lunch would be served. My father and uncle managed to see Palm Springs for free twice. All we had to do was listen to 2 half-day seminars. It was great! They also saw San Diego and Santa Barbara, courtesy of timeshare seminars. They did, of course, give up several days of their life, but as my uncle said, "I'm recording all the shows we're missing on my VCR." Once they had honed their skills, their tactics were simple. As my father explained to me, "I just go and tell them I have no money and my brother doesn't understand English." Sadly enough, my uncle Nematullah recently decided to return to Iran. This departure has left my father without a partner in crime. Despite his persistence, his sisters refused to join him because, frankly, they're too smart. My father, never one to give up hope, recently announced that he is trying to convince my mother to give timeshares another chance. "If she understood less English, she would enjoy the seminars a lot more," he told me. In the meantime, he has a lot more time for his other hobby, watching television, which, unlike yachting, fishing, or spelunking, is completely free. The Ham Amendment. One of my father's favorite foods is ham. This is not a problem if your name is Bob and you live in Alabama. But when you're Kazem living in Abadan, satisfying your ham cravings can be a challenge. During my childhood, Iran was a monarchy led by the Shah. His picture was everywhere. The serious expression on his face made it clear that this was an important person having important thoughts. His beautiful wife, Farah, was usually seen standing beside him in photos, wearing a large, bejeweled crown, which appeared rather uncomfortable, but managed to make her, too, look far more important than the average person walking down the street. They had 4 children, all of whom were envied by the entire Iranian population for leading perfect lives, lives which included French-speaking nannies, skiing lessons, fancy clothes, and the assumption of perpetual happiness. I didn't really think much about the royal family, except I had noticed that they owned a lot of big jewelry. My parents, however, were huge fans. My father firmly believed that the Shah would educate and modernize Iran. After his graduate years in Texas, my father had returned to Iran full of American optimism. With its vast oil reserves and abundance of smart people, Iran, according to my father, could really go places. When I was 5 years old, the Shah was scheduled to come to Abadan for the inauguration of the petrochemical plant. A parade had been arranged and a special float had been built for him. To avoid the large crowds, we decided to skip the parade, knowing that we would not be able to see anything. We were not, however, willing to miss our only opportunity for a brush with royalty. My father, a man whose engineering mind always comes up with a solution, devised the plan. On a scorching hot day, the day before the parade, my mother wore her Jackie Kennedy sleeveless dress, my brothers put on long-sleeved shirts and ties, and the 5 of us drove to the parade site in my father's air-conditioned Chevrolet. Granted, there was no parade, no cheering crowd, no music, and least of all, no royalty, but none of that mattered. We climbed on the beribboned float intended for the Shah, our faces protected by the awning built to shield the royal face from the blazing sun. We smiled. my father's camera captured our royal moment. What brought the Shah to Abadan was its seemingly endless oil supply. This natural gift was a mixed blessing, a bit like having a garden that stands out in the entire neighborhood. You know that eventually somebody's going to come and pick your flowers while you're sleeping. In our case, it was the British who came for the oil. The British were the first to realize the huge financial potential of the vast Iranian oil reserves. With the sound of cash registers ringing in executives' ears, British Petroleum negotiated an agreement with the Iranian government that allowed the British to drill for and sell the oil in exchange for a small sum. In a perfect world, the kindergarten teacher would have stood up before any documents were signed and said, "Time out for Britain. We'll renegotiate after a nap." But alas, with no teacher present to remind the participants of the universal concept of fairness, the British applied a different universal concept, greed. The agreement between British Petroleum and the government of Iran was destined for disaster. Fortunately, exploitation has a limited shelf life, and Iranians eventually woke up. In the early 1950s, the Prime Minister, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, nationalized Iran's oil. The British were forced to leave Iran. Unwilling to simply walk away from the golden egg-laying goose, the foreign oil companies banded together and boycotted Iranian oil, resulting in a huge economic downturn. Within 2 years after the nationalization of its oil, the Iranian economy lay in shambles. Political upheaval ensued. Once again, Iran was ripe for foreign exploitation. This time, with foreign powers working behind the scene, Dr. Mossadegh, the national hero, was ousted. History partly repeated itself, and the foreign oil companies once again took over the operation and exploitation of the Iranian oil industry. This time, however, Iran received a larger portion of the profits and more control over oil operations. By the time I was born in Abadan in 1965, there was no longer a large British population in town. A few foreigners remained, all employed by the operating companies. Iran was finally reaping most of the profits from its own oil. In the absence of the British, the residents of Abadan benefited from a city built by thoughtful British planners. We had swimming pools, clubhouses, and very orderly housing developments. My hometown looked different from any other Iranian city. Catering to the European expatriates, some stores in Abadan carried foreign goods, exotic products such as Ovaltine, Kit Kat candy bars, and ham. Even with the British gone, their canned and boxed foods remained in the stores, serving as a reminder of the exotic world that existed outside our borders. During his graduate years in America, my father had been deprived of his beloved Persian food. No steaming platters of saffron-infused rice, no tender chicken kebabs, no marinated lamb shanks with eggplant stew. Exhibiting the survival instinct of adaptation, he had developed a taste for cafeteria food, in particular jello and ham. After his return to Iran and subsequent marriage, he had convinced my mother to make jello on a fairly regular basis. I liked the wiggly stuff, but I preferred to eat the powder raw out of the palm of my hand. My father's ham cravings, however, were a different story. My mother would not touch the stuff with a 10-meter pole. She cringed at even the word jambon, the French word used in Iran for ham. I had no idea why my mother reacted so strongly. All I knew was that whenever my father wanted to buy ham, I was his chosen partner, and I was honored. The opportunity to spend time alone with my father was so rare that I would have done just about anything to have him all to myself. Had he wanted to rob a bank, I would happily have driven the getaway car. Unlike the Persian markets, where the fruits and vegetables were openly displayed, the tiny grocery stores that sold ham carried foods veiled in boxes and cans. Pictures hinted at the contents, although there was no rooster in the cornflakes. An air of mystery hung around these exotic foreign products, many of which had pictures of smiling people on the containers. None of the people looked Iranian, which led me to the obvious conclusion that there were a lot of happy people living in other countries. Once the ham was purchased, my father and I rode home, sharing the excitement felt by cavemen who had successfully hunted the elusive mammoth. My mother and brother stayed away from the kitchen, while my father meticulously prepared his meal with fresh tomatoes, pickles, and onions. He then sat down to savor every mouthful while I watched him, eating his beloved jambon.